Chapter 57. A fig, Dick, for your Mr. Addison, cries out his lady colon a gentleman who gives himself such airs and holds his head so high now. I hope your ladyship thinks as I do. I can't bear those very fair men with white eyelashes a black man for me. All the black men at table applauded, and made Mrs. Steele a bow for this compliment. As for this Mr. Addison, she went on, he comes to dine with the captain sometimes, never says a word to me, and then they walk upstairs both tipsy, to a dish of tea. I remember your Mr. Addison, when he had but one coat to his back, and that with a patch at the elbow. Indeed a patch at the elbow. You interest me, says Mr. St. John. 'Tis charming to hear of one man of letters from the charming wife of another. Law, I could tell you ever so much about him, continues the voluble lady. Hat do you think the captain has got now? A little hunchback fellow, a little hop-o'-my-thumb creature, that he calls a poet a little popish brat. Hush, there are two in the room, whispers her companion. Well, I call him popish, because his name is Pope, says the lady. 'Tis only my joking way. And this little dwarf of a fellow has wrote a pastoral poem all about shepherds and shepherdesses, you know. A shepherd should have a little crook, says my mistress, laughing from her end of the table. On which Mrs. Steele said, she did not know, but the captain brought home this queer little creature when she was in bed with her first boy, and it was a mercy he had come no sooner. And Dick raved about his genus, and was always raving about some nonsense or other. Which of the tattlers do you prefer, Mrs. Steele? Asked Mr. St. John. I never read but one, and think it all a pack of rubbish, sir, says the lady. Such stuff about bickerstaff, and distaff, and quarterstaff, as it all is. There's the captain going on still with the burgundy. I know he'll be tipsy before he stops Captain Steele. I drink to your eyes, my dear, says the captain, who seemed to think his wife charming, and to receive as genuine all the satiric compliments which Mr. St. John paid her. All this while the maid of honor had been trying to get Mr. Esmond to talk, and no doubt voted him a dull fellow. For, by some mistake, just as he was going to pop into the vacant place, he was placed far away from Beatrix's chair, who sat between his grace and my Lord Ashburnham, and shrugged her lovely white shoulders, and cast a look as if to say, pity me, to her cousin. My Lord Duke and his young neighbor were presently in a very animated and close conversation. Mrs. Beatrix could no more help using her eyes than the sun can help shining, and setting those it shines on a burning. By the time the first course was done the dinner seemed long to Esmond. By the time the soup came he fancied they must have been hours at table. And as for the sweets and jellies he thought they never would be done. At length the ladies rose, Beatrix throwing a Parthian glance at her duke as she retreated. A fresh bottle and glasses were fetched, and toasts were called. Mr. St. John asked His Grace the Duke of Hamilton and the company to drink to the health of His Grace the Duke of Brandon. Another lord gave General Webb's health, and may he get the command the bravest officer in the world deserves. Mr. Webb thanked the company, complimented his aide-de-camp, and fought his famous battle over again. Illest fatiguant, whispers Mr. St. John, avec sa trompette au nendel. Captain Steele, who was not of our side, loyally gave the health of the Duke of Marlborough, the greatest general of the age. I drink to the greatest general with all my heart, says Mr. Webb. There can be no gainsaying that character of him. My glass goes to the general, and not to the Duke, Mr. Steele. And the stout old gentleman emptied his bumper. To which Dick replied, by filling and emptying a pair of brimmers, one for the general and one for the duke. And now His Grace of Hamilton, rising up with flashing eyes, we had all been drinking pretty freely, proposed a toast to the lovely, to the incomparable Mrs. Beatrix Esmond. We all drank it with cheers, and my Lord Ashburnham especially, with a shout of enthusiasm. What a pity there is a Duchess of Hamilton, whispers St. John, who drank more wine, and yet was more steady than most of the others, and we entered the drawing room, where the ladies were at their tea. As for poor Dick, we were obliged to leave him alone at the dining table, where he was hiccuping out the lines from the campaign, in which the greatest poet had celebrated the greatest general in the world, and Harry Esmond found him, half an hour afterwards, in a more advanced stage of liquor, and weeping about the treachery of Tom Boxer. The drawing room was all dark to poor Harry, in spite of the grand illumination. Beatrix scarce spoke to him. When my Lord Duke went away, she practiced upon the next in rank, and plied my young Lord Ashburnham with all the fire of her eyes, and the fascinations of her wit. Most of the party were set to cards, and Mr. St. John, after yawning in the face of Mrs. Steele, whom he did not care to pursue any more, and talking in his most brilliant animated way to Lady Castlewood, whom he pronounced to be beautiful, of a far higher order of beauty than her daughter, presently took his leave, and went his way. The rest of the company speedily followed, my Lord Ashburnham the last, throwing fiery glances at the smiling young temptress, who had bewitched more hearts than is in her thrall. No doubt, as a kinsman of the house, Mr. Esmond thought fit to be the last of all in it. He remained after the coaches had rolled away after his dowager aunt's chair, and Flambeau had marched off in the darkness towards Chelsea, and the townspeople had gone to bed, who had been drawn into the square, to gape at the unusual assemblage of chairs and chariots, lackeys, and torchmen. The poor mean wretch lingered, yet for a few minutes, to see whether the girl would vouchsafe him a smile, or a parting word of consolation. But her enthusiasm of the morning was quite died out, or she chose to be in a different mood. She fell to joking about the dowdy appearance of Lady Betty, and mimicked the vulgarity of Mrs. Steele, and then she put up her little hand to her mouth and yawned, lighted a taper, and shrugged her shoulders, and dropping Mr. Esmond a saucy curtsy, sailed off to bed. The day began so well, Henry, that I hoped it might have ended better, was all the consolation that poor Esmond's fond mistress could give him, and as he trudged home through the dark alone, he thought with bitter rage in his heart, and a feeling of almost revolt against the sacrifice he had made. He would have me, thought he, had I but a name to give her. But for my promise to her father, I might have my rank and my mistress too. I suppose a man's vanity is stronger than any other passion in him, for I blush, even now, as I recall the humiliation of those distant days, the memory of which still smarts, though the fever of balked desire has passed away more than a score of years ago. When the writer's descendants come to read this memoir, I wonder will they have lived to experience a similar defeat and shame? Will they ever have knelt to a woman who has listened to them, and played with them, and laughed with them, who beckoning them with lures and caresses, and with yes smiling from her eyes, has tricked them onto their knees, and turned her back and left them? All this shame Mr. Esmond had to undergo, and he submitted, and revolted, and presently came crouching back for more. After this feast, my young Lord Ashburnham's coach was forever rolling in, and out of Kensington Square, his lady mother came to visit Esmond's mistress, and at every assembly in the town, wherever the maid of honor made her appearance, you might be pretty sure to see the young gentleman in a new suit every week, and decked out in all the finery that his tailor or embroiderer could furnish for him. My lord was forever paying Mr. Esmond compliments, bidding him to dinner, offering him horses to ride, and giving him 1,000 uncouth marks of respect and goodwill. At last, one night at the coffee house, whither my lord came considerably flushed and excited with drink, he rushes up to Mr. Esmond, and cries out, "I've me joy, my dearest colonel, I am the happiest of men." "The happiest of men needs no dearest colonel to give him joy," says Mr. Esmond. "Had is the cause of this supreme felicity? Haven't you heard?" says he. "Aunt, you know? I thought the family told you everything. The adorable Beatrix hath promised to be mine." "What? cries out Mr. Esmond, who had spent happy hours with Beatrix that very morning, had writ verses for her, that as he had sung at the harpsichord. "Yes," says he, "I waited on her today. I saw you walking towards Knightsbridge as I passed in my coach, and she looked so lovely, and spoke so kind, that I couldn't help going down on my knees, and am sure I am the happiest of men in all the world, and I'm very young, but she says I shall get older. And you know I shall be of age in 4 months, and there's very little difference between us, and I'm so happy. I should like to treat the company to something. Let us have a dozen bottles and drink the health of the finest woman in England." Esmond left the young lord tossing off bumper after bumper, and strolled away to Kensington to ask whether the news was true. 'Twas only too sure. His mistress's sad, compassionate face told him the story, and then she related what particulars of it she knew, and how my young lord had made his offer, half an hour after Esmond went away that morning, and in the very room where the song lay yet on the harpsichord, which Esmond had writ, and they had sung together. Book 3. Containing the end of Mr. Esmond's adventures in England. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.